Hello and welcome. You're listening to Speaking of Urology, the official podcast for Urology Times. As always, our commitment is to deliver urologists and allied health professionals timely and informative insights from leaders in the specialty. Our exclusive interviews bring expert analysis, practice advice, and policy perspectives to help our listeners practice more efficiently. I'm your host and associate editor, Hannah Clark. In this episode, we revisit a Urology Times X Spaces event in which Dr. Robert Brannigan and Dr. Juan Andino discussed the recent amendment to the male infertility guideline, which was developed in a collaboration between the American Urological Association and the American Society for Reproductive Medicine.
So let me start with a brief introduction. I'm very honored and happy to be here with Dr. Brannigan. Dr. Brannigan is the Vice Chair of Clinical Urology and the Chief of Male Reproductive Medicine and Men's Health at Northwestern's Department of Urology. And very importantly for this discussion today, he was one of the two guideline amendment chairs for the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, ASRM, and the American Urological Association guidelines on the diagnosis and treatment of infertility in men. And I'm Juan Andino. I'm one assistant professor of urology at UCLA, formerly at the University of Michigan. And I'm going to kick us off, Dr. Brannigan. I've noticed some important changes that are going to impact the male fertility evaluation and even treatment options on the guideline. But for those who are joining us live and those who are listening later on, can you share with us some of the three key changes that you've seen with these published amendments and the key things to keep in mind with these updated protocols for 2024?
Absolutely. Well, before I do that, I just want to thank you, Juan, for organizing this, and to Hannah as well. So thank you. This, it's important work. I think in our day-to-day care of patients, sometimes it can be hard to sift through all of the data and, determine what makes sense and what doesn't make sense, what you can rely on in terms of basing clinical decision-making off of and what you can't. And so that's why these guidelines are so important. So I think for me, three big takeaways from this guideline amendment are, first of all, the recommendation for a lower sperm concentration threshold to perform Y-chromosome microdeletion testing. So previously, that threshold was set at 5 million sperm per milliliter. And now really, that indication is only for men that have sperm concentrations less than 1 million sperm per milliliter. And the rationale for that was, if we do testing in men who have sperm concentrations between 1 and 5 million, only 0.8% of them turned out to have a Y chromosome microdeletion based on a meta-analysis that was recently published, whereas the positivity rate for men under a million was 5%, so much higher. So trying to avoid some unnecessary testing. The second big takeaway is, I think, a more strong endorsement of pelvic MRI imaging for men with suspected ejaculatory duct obstruction. Previously, the main approach for those patients is TRUST and seminal vesical aspiration, which is an invasive approach, obviously. And then third, the third big takeaway is the recommendation to consider use of testicular sperm in men with elevated sperm DNA fragmentation testing results.
Yeah, those are fantastic. And I, as I was looking through these, and I had the privilege to be a peer reviewer for the first time since transitioning from fellowship to being faculty, those were some of the key three things that I was also noticed were going to be a big change. Let's jump in and discuss a little bit more one by one. So for instance, the Y chromosome microdeletion, can you provide a little bit more context to our listeners? Certainly I can imagine some patients, for example, getting concerned, well, what if I fall into that 0.8%? But given the lack of insurance coverage for these tests, can you share with us a little bit about what that positive impact will be of avoiding over-testing?
Yeah, so obviously for some of our couples, the diagnostic part of infertility is covered, but for a lot of patients, there may not be coverage, or maybe they're capped on the total amount of dollars that they can spend on their fertility care. And so literally every dollar counts. And so I think that's a big driver for this recommendation to really carefully look at and consider what works and what makes sense for our couples. So again, it's not to say that there won't be any individuals with sperm concentrations greater than a million who, you know, might not have a Y chromosome microdeletion issue. But again, the utility of that test just goes way down for men over a million sperm concentration, a million sperm per milliliter concentration.
Yeah, that's extremely helpful. And certainly if it's not going to necessarily impact the next steps or decision making for that patient or that couple, exactly right. Kind of this idea of financial toxicity that was first cited or kicked off in the oncology world has been gaining a lot of traction in other areas of urology, like male fertility or sexual health. So it was great to see that kind of applied in the guidelines from this aspect, really almost as a protective mechanism for patients.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I do think, again, the test, when it does come back positive, there's a lot of utility to it. Obviously, for our patients who have complete AZF-A or complete AZF-B microdeletions, you know, the prospects for sperm retrieval in those patients is zero or close to zero based on the current literature. And for obviously an AZF-C microdeletion, a more positive outcome with over 50% of those patients having sperm on microtesting. So it's still a valuable test, but again, want to make sure we're testing the right folks.
Yeah, exactly right. It's really kind of focusing in who's going to benefit. And I think that'll tie in really nicely, actually, this idea of more appropriate selection of which tests we're ordering or other clinicians in the community are ordering for male fertility. You know, that second point that you brought up about pelvic MRI, it's become more accessible, more widely available. And it highlights that statement 23 in the guidelines, but it highlights that, you know, this type of imaging, certainly not trust, shouldn't just be part of a shotgun approach at the beginning of that first visit of the routine workup, but really only doing a transrectal ultrasound or a pelvic MRI if there's a suspicion for ejaculatory duct obstruction. Could you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think that a lot of us see well-intentioned physicians, sometimes physicians who aren't even urologists, maybe primary care doctors, who have an interest in male reproductive health and want to get their patients going with a workup, which is very understandable. But there is, you know, definitely a lot of testing that just doesn't need to be done. And certainly wholesale scrotal ultrasounds, wholesale MRIs of the pelvis, have cost. They've got limited utility if they're used in an unindicated setting. And also one, you know, there's the problem of potentially, you know, detecting issues that are not real problems, mm-hmm. but that nonetheless need to be further pursued. And I think we see that especially with scrotal ultrasounds that are ordered in men who may have Leydig cell hyperplasia or other issues that are not medical problems, but that, you know, once you identify them, may necessitate additional diagnostics or additional follow-up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Or just the cyst, epididymal cyst, being the main reason for a, you know, consultation when it really just has no clinical impact for the patient or for the couple trying to achieve a pregnancy. And I'll highlight for the listeners and for those who are listening to this, you know, in the podcast format, that the other key aspect of that statement is, you know, the suspicion of ejaculatory duct obstruction. So taking a step back, this statement really builds on the idea of the semen analysis being a key aspect of the male fertility evaluation. And so if a patient has a semen analysis and they have low volume, less than 1.4 milliliters, or an acidic pH less than 7, then that's really where we need to be considering or worrying about ejaculatory duct obstruction. And that's where that further testing is going to be more indicated and more useful.
Yeah, that's right, Dr. Andino. So I completely agree with that. And I think that pelvic MRI, the more we've used it, the more it's won me over. And the, you know, the discussion part of the guidelines document for statement 23 gets into this, and that an MRI may help you better differentiate the specific type of cyst that you're dealing with, whether it's an ejaculatory duct cyst or more of a midline cyst. And that, I think, can help us, you know, plan our procedure more effectively. I think the size criteria, sizing the seminal vesicle, sizing the ejaculatory ducts, is also more precise with MRI versus transrectal ultrasound. Keep in mind, during the TRUST procedure, those of us that do it, the probe is in the rectum and it's compressing the prostate and compressing mm-hmm. the duct, compressing the seminal vesicles. So there's no doubt that there's some distortion of the anatomy that happens during the measurement of the anatomy.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And then going into that third statement before we expand on a couple of the other changes that we're seeing, but again, we're kind of highlighting top three things that we that Dr. Brannigan identified as important updates in the male fertility amendments. So this idea of clinicians should consider the role of testicular sperm in non-azoospermic patients, so patients who have ejaculated sperm, but they have an elevated DNA fragmentation index. You know, I would say I've seen this for probably at least 2 or 3 years at conferences, in academic centers, grand rounds, but it is so nice to see it, you know, directly addressed in these amendments. Talk to us a little bit more about DNA fragmentation and how we are seeing that this plays a role in the male fertility evaluation.
No, I think especially in the area of recurrent pregnancy loss, this is certainly, I think, one of the key areas. If we're seeing couples that are grappling with that, you know, definitely want to consider pursuing sperm DNA fragmentation testing. You know, there was a meta-analysis with pooled data from 13 different studies showing elevated sperm DNA fragmentation levels in the male partners compared to controls. And this and other studies and other work done by a few centers around the world are championing this, showing that DNA fragmentation is an issue. I would point out that going to the testicle to get sperm does seem to offer some clinical advantage mm-hmm. for some couples. There's some literature to suggest that may be counteracted by an increased risk of aneuploidy with testicular sperm compared to ejaculated mm-hmm. sperm. So it's sort of a balancing act. But I would say that the literature that's available now is encouraging. I do know that there's some emerging literature about, you know, repetitive ejaculation with a short abstinence interval mm-hmm. leading up to, you know, use of sperm, particularly in IVF, and that, you know, looks to be some encouraging literature. There's going to need to be a stronger signal for that literature, stronger evidence base, I think, for that to make it in as a guideline statement or into the discussion. But obviously, that's an area that we need to follow closely, because if we can do, you know, get more favorable sperm in a non-invasive fashion, that will serve our patients well.
Absolutely. And I'll tie in. So those were three key things Dr. Brannigan is highlighting from the male fertility amendments that just recently came out. I'll reiterate them. So Y chromosome microdeletion testing threshold has changed to being less than 1 million sperm per milliliter. And with signs of a production problem. So typically there's either testicular atrophy or an elevated FSH. Another key aspect that has changed is that we're not just routinely recommending ordering, this was never the recommendation, but more direction around the fact that transrectal ultrasound and a pelvic MRI are both good options for the patients where we suspect an ejaculatory duct obstruction. And this particularly new area where the data has been growing that testicular sperm may still serve a role, even if patients can have ejaculated sperm, but testing has confirmed they're shown elevated DNA fragmentation index. I'm going to build on that last one because it ties in really nicely to something that I think I'm sure you see in practice. I've seen over the last year here at UCLA, you know, one of the other statements in the guidelines talks about the fact that there's two other areas in which a male partner should be evaluated, even if the semen analysis is normal. And that's the recurrent pregnancy loss, exactly as you mentioned, but also couples with failed assistive reproductive technology cycles. And there's a couple tests that may provide additional information, but give us some context for the listeners. You know, some people may hear or think that, okay, if the semen analysis is perfect, then I'm good. What would you counter for these types of scenarios?
Yeah, and that's where, you know, that assumption that if the semen testing looks good, the couple's okay, and the male partner is okay, couldn't be, you know, further from the truth. And so we know that karyotype abnormalities are present in about 6% of men overall. And we know in certain situations, certain instances, that can lead to a condition where the male partner, his gamete is leading to, you know, recurrent pregnancy loss mm-hmm. in the embryo. And so if you don't look for the chromosomal abnormality, you're not going to find it. And so certainly for recurrent pregnancy loss, not just the female partner, but also the male partner needs to be evaluated. And the first test is, of course, a karyotype test. And the second test then is the sperm DNA fragmentation testing that we talked a little bit about, because this also can lead to this issue with recurrent pregnancy loss, failure of embryo development in the setting of IVF ICSI or recurrent pregnancy loss. And, you know, these tests are readily available. The karyotype test, as I think most of your listeners know, is a blood test typically. And then the DNA fragmentation test, you know, I think most of us are using ejaculated sperm sent to different labs. There are different tests that can be done. But at the end of the day, you know, looking for those breaks in the DNA. And I think certainly for, you know, for our men, I would say the literature says this, and I would say clinically, it does seem to serve as an important marker for our men who are going to encounter difficulties when they have an abnormally elevated level.
Yeah. No, and I think from the kind of emotional and psychological toll that the fertility journey can have on the male patient, but also the couple, making sure that there's no stone unturned. I think this is a very critical recommendation from the guidelines, and that, you know, not just to put everything on the semen analysis. Yes, that should be the first step, and it gives us a lot of information. But I really like to see that this statement highlighted that there's these additional scenarios where the male partner should still be referred to see a reproductive urologist.
So much of the burden falls even now to the female partner. And we're definitely seeing a trend where I think a lot of our patients who are doing their homework are coming in for the male partner evaluation first. They realize that it's pretty straightforward, and there's a lot of valuable information to be gleaned from it. And optimizing the male partner's reproductive potential, as we know from an abundance of different studies in our literature, can in the end decrease the time to pregnancy, and B, if a couple needs assisted techniques, diminish the level of treatment that the female partner may need to undergo.
Yeah, I think that's a critical aspect. It's really looking to optimize things from both sides so that even if assistive reproductive technology is needed, can we increase the success rates? So it's really kind of a win-win scenario there. And then one additional, Dr. Dubin, yeah. I think, fortunately had to fall off of our listening, but I wanted to bring this up in particular, thinking of some of his work, a former Northwestern Urology Fellow. But one of the key aspects, and this was even recently highlighted in kind of the general media, I think it was a Wall Street Journal article around testosterone use and how, you know, widely exogenous testosterone is being used. But I love the highlight in the amendments, and particularly in the supporting test, that if a patient is interested in current or near future fertility, you know, really we should be avoiding exogenous therapy.
Yeah, so this is such an important point, and I really give, you know, Dr. Dubin, Dr. Halpin, and others that were involved with that study a lot of credit. It was a secret shopper study, and it was proposed as a male with normal testosterone looking for therapy. And the results were concerning because, you know, for the secret shopper, there was easy access at most sites to testosterone therapy without really guidance on the potential pitfalls and without guidance, certainly on the potential impact on fertility. And we see this, right? We see this in our practices where patients will access these therapies and just not be clear on the potential downsides that can be associated with it. So this isn't to say that all centers that provide this kind of care aren't paying attention to the patient's needs, but a lot of them are not. And so much so that it obviously made its way into the Wall Street Journal just about 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago tomorrow, in an important step, in an important story.
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing that I thought was quite important that the supporting text highlighted is that there are situations in which perhaps a patient or a couple is interested in fertility, but it's not immediate. It's in the future. Maybe it's in a year, maybe it's in 6 months, that there is some very limited data. That there are methods like using HCG or HCG in combination with Clomid or anastrozole to still preserve some endogenous signaling of the testicle and maintain that testicular function. So I thought that was a really nice addition from the committee that is protective of some of the work, because there are the patients, I'm sure you're seeing them as well, that have very significant hypogonadal symptoms if they're coming off of the exogenous testosterone completely. And so there are ways to try to mitigate these risks, but it's a much more nuanced and detailed discussion.
Yeah, and it's really important, Dr. Andy, you know, to realize that, you know, sometimes these patients are between a rock and a hard place because when they come off their testosterone replacement therapy, their exogenous testosterone, they feel crummy. Now, you know, the testosterone deficiency guidelines do point out these alternative therapies that you were just alluding to, HCG, clomiphene citrate, and then aromatase inhibitors. And, you know, those are invaluable, and we often use those effectively with our patients, but sometimes they need to be combined with one another. There are those occasional patients where, you know, they just, again, clinically are not feeling well and may not get the rise in testosterone to normal levels with these alternative therapies. And so, you know, in our practice, we have a handful of patients on combined testosterone and HCG therapy. And I can't say that I'm advocating for this or that there's a strong body of literature out there. But I think what I'm saying is that there are some of our patients who just can't function with these alternative therapies alone. And I think at least conceptually, the combination of HCG with exogenous testosterone does provide some support and anecdotally seems to provide some stimulation of the, you know, testicular anatomy and physiology.
Yep, I completely agree. That's a great way to put it. And again, just kind of a plug-in for the importance of thinking about both sides of the partnership in terms of fertility and also the increasing awareness. So I think one of the really great impacts of that Wall Street Journal article is that for the folks who may have been receiving exogenous therapy and not had a detailed discussion like this about the potential impacts on spermatogenesis, it's just shining a little bit of a spotlight. That's not to say that, you know, black or white, completely avoid or must do, but that when fertility is part of the equation, that it just becomes a little bit more of a complex medical situation.
That's right. I completely agree with you.
Well, those have been some of the key portions. I think we still have a few minutes left here in our X spaces. So I'm going to highlight some other things that I had made note of or thought were really interesting. And you brought this up at the very beginning, Dr. Brannigan, and I want to circle back to it. You know, scrotal ultrasound is, again, not needed as a routine test. It's something that, you know, shouldn't just be reflexively ordered if there's a question or concern about fertility. But there's a couple of comments in the supporting text about some potential clinical scenarios where it may be. Can you share a little bit about those?
So certainly, you know, I think that a patient who has a difficult scrotal exam, and we've all seen these patients, right? They may have a hypoplastic scrotum or they may be obese. And those patients, I think, you know, getting a scrotal ultrasound can be informative and can just help, you know, A, provide you diagnostic information or B, confirm, you know, suspicions that you might have about the patient's underlying anatomy. I think, you know, in my hands, that's the case where I would say, practically speaking, I use it the most. You know, in some patients who have lipomas of the cord, it may be difficult in those individuals to, you know, determine whether or not they've got a clinically apparent varicocele. But again, that's kind of, I think, more the exception rather than the rule when it comes to ultrasound imaging.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And those are some great, you know, clinical context or challenging exams. I will say one area of interest for me, just because I've done some work in the realm of telehealth and current fellow, Dr. Kathy Nam, has an abstract coming up at the ASRM conference. If more of this fertility care is pocketed, you know, there's a workforce shortage for all urologists, even more so for reproductive urologists. I think it's going to be interesting as we move forward beyond the kind of COVID-19 and the expansion of telehealth services is, are there going to be scenarios if someone doesn't have a local reproductive urologist where potentially, you know, this can be an adjunct test to provide additional information, exactly as you said. So stay tuned, folks. There's a little bit of data on that, on the use of scrotal ultrasound for patients, you know, receiving care via telehealth for fertility at this year's upcoming ASRM.
I mean, that's how the field's evolving, right? We're seeing, you know, many groups now where the initial visit is by virtual format. And so we need to always continuously rethink how we're doing things, what we're doing, and make full use of the technology to deliver effective care. And so I would look at that as being an effective means of using ultrasound in that particular scenario, for sure.
And then one of the last topics that I wanted to bring up because it's unique, it's very interesting, and kind of a niche area. But one of the statements in the guidelines, statement 37, highlights that, you know, infertile males with ejaculatory duct obstruction, which we've talked a little bit about, where that pelvic MRI may give us a little bit more information. The guidelines focus on, you know, transurethral resection of the ejaculatory ducts and or surgical sperm extraction. I have you here live on the call and your expertise. I feel like over the last two AUAs, I've seen more videos or presentations around this technique called seminal vesiculoscopy. Obviously, it seems like something that doesn't have the level of rigor of evidence to make it into the guidelines. But what are your thoughts on this? Have you ever done any of these procedures or see a potential emerging role in the future?
I haven't done them, but I've seen them, you know, as a reviewer of different, especially like video abstracts. And I think the greatest value for them is going to probably be when the etiology of ejaculatory duct obstruction due to intraluminal calculi and the, you know, the calculi are being, you know, treated like a stone in the ureter with lithotripsy. That the data that I've seen, that to me looks like probably the best indication. Of course, you know, if you had an area of stenosis, you could feed a wire through. Very often these are like pediatric ureteroscopes that are used for this procedure. You know, could fit a wire through and do balloon dilation. I've seen abstracts looking at that as well. So, I mean, again, I think we need to be open-minded about these approaches. As you were alluding to, the statement 37 does say that, you know, the option is there certainly to go for surgical sperm extraction. I would say this, that when a patient has a, you know, true ejaculatory duct obstruction and you do the TRED and it goes well, I mean, those patients are very often off to the races, they and their partners, and have a great rate of natural conception. So, I mean, I think, you know, not all patients want to go through that, but again, it's outpatient surgery. It takes a very short amount of time. The recovery is short for that. In fact, I would argue that the recovery for a TRED for many of our patients is less than for a surgical sperm extraction.
I can imagine that. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, endoscopic procedure, you're in and out. Wonderful. Well, I think we're getting close to the end of our time. I wanted to highlight one thing, you know, take advantage of this captive audience, so to speak, who's interested in the male fertility world. In addition to these 2024 amendments, you know, it is important to note that there was a last year, there was a committee opinion from the ASRM that broadened the definition of infertility. So a lot of the definitions historically have focused on a man and a woman trying to achieve a pregnancy over a period of trying of at least 6 months if the partner is over age 35 or over 12 months. But ASRM appropriately identified that this was leaving out some of our patients and some of our couples. And so I wanted to take a moment just to highlight that now the infertility definition from ASRM has been expanded to include the inability to achieve a successful pregnancy based on a patient's medical, sexual, and reproductive history, their age, physical findings, diagnostic testing, or any combination of those factors, or in patients or couples where medical intervention, including the use of donor gametes or donor embryos, may be needed to achieve a successful pregnancy.
That was well summarized, Dr. Andino. Absolutely. And, you know, ASRM put a lot of thought into this new definition, a much more inclusive definition. And, you know, hats off to the ASRM and to, you know, the AUA for recognizing this updated perspective and definition.
And with that, I think that's the majority of the content that I wanted to focus on. You know, folks, really thank you for being here live with us to listen in. And also all of those who are going to listen down the road to this in the podcast format. We really saw this as an opportunity for dissemination. So obviously, Dr. Brannigan, the rest of the peer reviewers, the guideline committee have spent countless hours shifting through data, reviews, studies to make sure that this is all put in paper and easily accessible on the internet. But we know that sometimes guidelines go and, you know, just sit online or sit on a website where it hasn't been downloaded. So any opportunity, and this was a great one to help spread the information, I think it's always a very good experience.
Can I just give a quick shout out to the AUA? Yeah, AUA, ASRM, the AUA's Practice Guidelines Committee. And all the AUA staff that were so important in this, and the staff from ECRI that does the literature review and curates the evidence base. So, and Dr. Corey Tannercutt, who most of you know, also was a valuable partner with this whole process. So, and thank you very much, Dr. Andina, for the chance to chat today about this amendment.
Yeah, it's been lovely.
You just heard an exclusive interview with Dr. Robert Brannigan and Dr. Juan Andino on the AUA-ASRM Male Infertility Guideline Amendment. Be sure to subscribe to Speaking of Urology on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps. You can get the latest in urology news, practice management advice, and health policy updates by visiting our website, urologytimes.com, or by following us on X, formerly Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook at Urology Times. Thank you for listening.